Hello, it's Monday, August the 2nd. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we've won more gold at the Olympic Games. Working from home, it's going to continue indefinitely, it seems. There's chaos over foreign travel. The Amber watch list has been scrapped, we think, before it was even launched. The Blue Wall, a book showing why the Tories have been the dominant political party of the last 70, if not 100 years. But first, more and more people now are paying to go private to have operations on everything from their heart to their spine because of the record rise in waiting lists. Growing numbers of patients are opting to pay for life-saving surgery because of the huge and growing NHS waiting list. Charities say many more patients who've been waiting for months or even years are choosing to go private as a last resort. Some are even taking out loans to cover the cost. Roy Lilly is a founder member of the NHS Trust Federation and leading health commentator and joins me now. Roy, there was always a problem with the waiting list anyway. Then we have the pandemic and they are now at an all-time record. 5 million people, I think, was the last time I looked.
True. And I think probably it's more than 5 million. I guess the truth is, Andrew, we don't really know how many people, because a lot of people during COVID just didn't go to their GP, just didn't turn up and have soldiered on. So 5 million actually might be a concern.
Yeah, and the heart surgery is among the areas where people are going private the most. And that can cost, Roy, £20,000. That's a lot of money. And I'm quite sure your insurance company are not going to pay it.
No, and the whole business of private insurance is really very interesting. I mean, the fortunes of the private medical insurance industry ebb and flow with the NHS's ability to cope with waiting lists. If we go back to the days of New Labour, when Andy Burnham was the Secretary of State for Health, I remember him standing up in a House of Commons and saying there are no waiting lists. It wasn't quite true, but it was pretty nearly true. And of course, nobody had private medical insurance. A lot of companies do have private medical insurance, PMI as it's called, and they give it as a benefit to their staff. Mainly now that's become sort of high-end executives, and it's not for the, you know, for the likes of the rest of us. Self-pay started before COVID to become more interesting. And we found a hip operation, for example, if you get an uncomplicated hip, it's going to cost between $5,000 and $7,000. And we found a lot of families were clubbing together and buying a new hip for granny because of the waiting list had started to build before COVID. Now, of course, they're just kind of reaching over the horizon. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. If you just do some back of the fag packet numbers, we know there's 5 million that are waiting. But in the course of a year, the NHS will do about 10 million operations. 2 million will be emergencies and get done anyway, and 8 will be what we call elective procedures. That's like hips, knees and hernias and cataracts. Now, if there are 5 million waiting, plus another 8 million that come in, that's 13 million that are going to appear on the waiting list this year.
Yeah.
And the NHS will work its way through it. The Prime Minister is saying he wants the waiting list sorted by the next election, which is about 36 months. Well, we've got another sort of three and a half years maybe of 8 million people coming in. That's something like 30 million operations the NHS has got to do in 36 months. They've got no chance.
Exactly. It's interesting, Roy, because I'm also looking at, it's not just heart area, the spinal cord and brain procedures have shot up. And Spire Healthcare, you'll know them, they're our second largest private provider, says the number of inquiries from self-pay patients is up by 30% this year already. And they're looking at urology, prostate, bladder, kidneys, gastroenterology, the stomach and digestive system. Basically, it's the whole gamut of medical procedures.
Yes, it is. I mean, and people get worried about their health and they think, well, let's find out how much. But of course, the other point is that we don't really have a proper private medical sector in this country. I mean, they employ some nurses and all their administrators, of course. But fundamentally, the engine room of private care are NHS surgeons and NHS anaesthetists. Now, the NHS is going to be pretty busy. Once the sort of COVID thing has subsided, there'll be a national plan to try and scythe into these waiting lists, and the NHS will start doing three sessions of operations a day. You know, at the moment we do about two, sometimes three. And they'll absolutely make the assets sweat in the NHS, and that means a shed load of overtime and surgeons and anaesthetists being busy in the NHS. Now, most private staff is done by NHS surgeons and anaesthetists in the evenings and weekends. If anybody's ever had an operation listening to this in the private sector, they'll know that they were admitted in the evenings and seen in the evenings and weekends and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's mainly the private medical business is mainly predicated on NHS surgeons and anaesthetists moonlighting evenings and weekends. Here's the problem. The real pinch point is that there's an 8% shortage of anaesthetists, and you can't operate on anybody without anaesthetists. So you've got a big problem now. The NHS has got a big problem because we don't have enough anaesthetists. In a hospital, you can have a registrar, that's a junior doctor, doing the anaesthetics in an operation, but the private sector, you can't. It's got to be a consultant. So I think they're going to struggle with waiting lists in the same way the NHS is.
And if Boris Johnson is serious, Roy, about getting waiting lists down before the next general election, of course, there's a political imperative there for him. There's only one way he can really do that. That's pumping a lot more money to the NHS, and that means tax rises, and pretty substantial ones too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you couple that up with the future of social care.
Yeah.
And there's a big chunk of money got to come from somewhere. But if we just focus on operations, you know, the average cost of an operation, I mean, you can get, you know, from a simple carpal tunnel operation for £300 or £400 through to, you know, major cardiac surgery, which runs into thousands. But if you just take a punt and say, well, the average cost of an operation is going to be around £3,000, you know, you multiply £3,000 by 5 million or 8 million, and suddenly you realize the billion quid that the NHS has had to recover from COVID, it doesn't touch the sides. I mean, this is going to cost a fortune. But this is one of those times where throwing money at it is not going to work because we just simply don't have enough staff. Now, most operating theatres will operate on two sessions a day. Then, okay, we can jack that up and say it's going to do three sessions a day and do the maintenance and the cleaning and what have you overnight. You might even get 3.5 sessions in. If you really make the assets sweat, the next question, you know, if someone's in hospital trying to schedule all these rotas, the next question is, well, where do we get the staff from? And it's not just the operating room staff. You've got recovery staff, and then you've got, of course, you've got ward staff. And the big problem there, of course, has been the pressure on the wards from COVID. But, you know, assuming COVID subsides, then it ricochets right throughout the system. This is not just, you know, we'll fix this by operations. I remember years ago, I was part of an initiative where we sent cardiac patients to Belgium because of the European Union. We could do that then. And I mean, that was regarded very risky and very dodgy.
Yeah,
but we did it. We did it very safely, and patients had a great time, and you know, there was never any problems. But because you can't do that now, we can't do it now mainly because of the EU thing. But even then, all of the healthcare systems around the world are under pressure. Everywhere you look, they've all got waiting time problems.
Absolutely. Fascinating. That's Roy Lilly, a founder member of the NHS Trust Federation. Thanks for joining me. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Plans by the government for a so-called amber watch list for holiday destinations appear to be in danger of being scrapped before they're even put in place. Under the proposals, travellers would be warned that destinations face being placed on the red list while they're away, but concern over the impact on the travel industry means we're pretty certain the whole idea is going to be shelved. Robert Griggs is the Policy and Public Affairs Director at Airlines UK, and he joins me now. Robert, if this policy had come in, I think we would then have had, would we have had six different positions on the so-called traffic light system? We'd have had green, amber, amber plus, amber watch, red, and weren't we going to have a green something or other too?
Yeah, a green watch list as well. So
yeah,
it's hard to keep track, but I think a good half dozen now.
Baffling, and it's already pretty baffling. Has common sense seen the light? Because we know the Chancellor intervened. He wrote a letter to the Prime Minister. Odd that he needed to write a letter to the Prime Minister, considering they live next door. And the letter mysteriously found its way to the front page of the Sunday Times. But in that letter, he was pretty clear that the industry, the aviation industry that you support, is in dire danger, almost of collapse, if this red traffic light system continues.
Yeah, we're in a really still difficult place. And this would have been pretty much the last thing we needed at the moment. But rather than sort of additional categories and warning people that are fully vaccinated that you might be stuck in a hotel on your return, we should be seeing more green countries. So it would have been, the complete wrong direction when we're already falling behind. We're well behind Europe in terms of how much their flights have come back. They're not pre-pandemic, but they're something like 50-60% 2019 levels. We're 16%.
Only 16.
In terms of forward booking. So something is not right in terms of what we're doing here in the UK. Hopefully we won't see this come through this week.
And of course, only 16% compared to 50 or 60% in other parts of the world in Europe. And yet we've had the fantastic vaccine rollout. Where's the dividend for that? And also we've got this extraordinary position where holidaymakers can come in, or travellers can come in from the European Union, including France, as long as they're double vaxxed and have no quarantine whatsoever. But if I wanted to go to France this week, I'd have to quarantine for 10 days when I got back.
Yeah, exactly. And we supported the traffic light system when it started a few months ago. It's not in an ideal world, we wouldn't have to have any of these kinds of restrictions. But we know, particularly back then, that we were still living in the world with the pandemic, and we needed to do what we could to get travel moving again. The problem we've seen is we've seen this, red, amber, green turn into, as you said, sort of six categories, so getting more complicated. We still don't really know what's behind the decisions when countries are put into red, amber, or green. So there's still a lack of transparency about, how are these decisions being made? And, we saw that with France, we saw that with Spain going back and forth, et cetera. So there are several issues with it. And that's, we haven't even got onto the cost of testing, whether the level of test we have to take is still proportionate, those sorts of things.
I was going to ask you about that because and I've heard ministers saying until they're blue in the face that the cost of testing is going to come down. But I read also at the weekend that the cheaper test, you can't get one of those until September. So if you currently do need to test to go abroad or when you get back, it's going to be one of the expensive tests. And I think it could add £600 testing to the average family holiday abroad.
Yeah, indeed. So at the moment, the requirements are for PCR testing, so it's the kind of gold standard, and you have to take, even from green countries, you have to take, if you're double vaccinated and you're coming from a green country, you still need to do that on day two on your return. So lots of countries are allowing sort of the cheaper rapid tests, the kinds of tests that you can take, you get handed out at train stations, the boxes, the blue test, the NHS test. We still can't use those, and our argument is very much, look, we know red countries, absolutely, we need testing, we need all those, we've supported those kinds of restrictions, but the world has changed with the vaccine rollout, and we just think that the risk balance is just not there yet. And travel is still very much sort of treated as if we're in a sort of pre-vaccine world, almost, is our concern. So testing, cost of testing, it's still putting holidays out of reach for lots of families. We need to do something about that.
And there's also evidence, of course, too, that the AstraZeneca vaccine is completely able to deal with the beta variant, which was the problem about, which is why France went on the Amber Plus list.
Yeah, so I think we've seen some data coming out of Canada, and I think there was AstraZeneca in terms of whether or not you might catch COVID was a little bit under the other vaccines, but in terms of the risk of hospitalizations and deaths, all the vaccines we've seen have been highly effective against all the variants we've seen. So the kinds of knee-jerk decisions to put things on watch lists and others, that it's so disruptive, and it's a difficult one. We've backed really quite strict measures for travel for 18 months now, knowing that health has to come first. Mm. But whereas we've seen lots of other parts of the world start to open up, take pragmatic steps, we know it won't be overnight, but the UK always seems to be that one step behind in terms of moving. And it is affecting jobs, livelihoods, and people's ability to see friends and family. I think something needs to change.
I'm just going to ask you just finally, Robert, of course, the UK is a very important hub. Heathrow is a very important hub airport. Was there a risk, the longer these wretched restrictions were in place, that its ascendancy in that area could be threatened?
Well, yes. So, yeah, aviation is by its nature, it's international. You don't have to come and fly the UK. And there are hubs, and even before COVID, you know, there are hubs in Europe, Paris, Amsterdam, others, who would love to take Heathrow's business. They would love to take flights away from the UK. And that's absolutely fine. That's all competition. But the problem is, at the moment, they're finding that the UK is being held back such that that the longer we are like this and we are losing connectivity, we're losing routes, we're losing people, the harder it's going to be for us to get back to where we were. And we were the third largest aviation market outside China and the US. So punching well above our weight in terms of a size of country, aviation was so important. The risk is we get so far behind, it just gets that much harder to recover.
Absolutely. That's Robert Griggs. He's Policy and Public Affairs Director at Airlines UK. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Toryboypierce. Having 3 days at home and working two in the office or the business place of work is set to become the new normal because of the pandemic. Many big firms have already agreed to the changes. The Institute of Directors are arguing 2/3 of business leaders will allow remote working. So what should we make of that? Bearing in mind last week, PwC warned younger people in particular that working from home permanently would be that bad for their career prospects. Dr. Roger Barker is Director of Policy at the Institute of Directors, and he joins me now. Dr. Barker, is it inevitable? That's it now. We're going to do three at home and two in the office, or the other way around?
I think that it seems to be the trend for the time being. This, of course, is a completely new situation for all of us. But coming out of the pandemic, I think it's actually providing both employers and employees with a kind of a unique opportunity to change the nature of work and the workplace. And at least for the time being, I think this seems to be a good way forward. Whether, though, it will bed in permanently and whether we'll start to gradually edge back towards old practices is another question. And there may be kind of underlying pressures which push in that direction over time.
You make the point, and I think it's a very interesting point, that this change, the pandemic has created is far greater than any radical reform or regulation that any government could ever have thought of.
That's absolutely right. And it's interesting actually to hear some politicians recently saying that we still need to make regulatory reforms to flexible working regulation. That strikes me as slightly strange actually, because we are experiencing a revolutionary change actually without regulation, due purely to circumstances, something which no politician could ever have envisaged or could have thought to achieve.
Why do politicians always think they have to bring in more regulations, more rules and more laws? When I hear that governments accused of not doing anything, I think good, because when they do legislate, they tend to mess it all up anyway.
Well, yes, I think some politicians are in a difficult position at the moment because they feel perhaps they want to be ahead of the curve, but the curve is already far out in front of, of anything that most people have thought of. So it's it's sort of left them on the hop a bit.
And it's just looking at some of the big names. So NatWest expects 9 in 10 staff to work while at home. Asda saying if its employees can work from any location, they'll let them. And John Lewis has introduced the option of flexible working for all head office staff. I mean, particularly if you're an administrator or in IT, which is a huge industry, of course, IT, I guess you can work from home quite easily.
Yes, I think that's the case. I mean, we've surveyed our members and there's about 20% of them that for which remote working doesn't work, you know, where they will want their employees completely back in the office. But for the remainder, there is pretty much a recognition that some degree of remote working is absolutely a possibility and indeed desirable. So ranging between one to four days a week in the office, depending on the employer.
When the pandemic first started, this podcast I did from my home, from my study at home, and the entire newspaper was produced with, I think, probably just one or two people in the building. Who'd have thought
it? It's incredible. And the other interesting thought is that if the pandemic had happened 10 years ago, or perhaps even less, it just wouldn't have been possible to move online in this way. The technology wasn't quite ready at that point. But the two things have come together, and now we have this revolutionary change.
And it's important in the papers today, you'll have seen it, Dr. Barker, a £5 billion plans to upgrade and roll out broadband, particularly in rural areas. Really important that that happens to facilitate and enable people who do want to work from home.
That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the big policy ideas of the government is levelling up. You know, this idea that people can work from wherever they wish within the United Kingdom. You're not going to be advantaged or disadvantaged depending on your location. And this, of all the policies that you can think of, I would have thought this digital rollout across the countries is the thing that will make it happen most of all.
And what about you, Dr. Barker? Do you work from home or in the IOD building in it's in Pall Mall, aren't you?
That's right. Well, it's funny you should say that, Andrew, because last week I had my first 2 days back in the office after having worked at home since last year.
Yeah.
And this week, again, I'm going to be working 2 days in the office. So moving in the direction of our members.
Yeah. And was it good to be back? Of course, you see colleagues, and I still think meetings face to face are better than Zoom.
It was, I have to say, it was absolutely terrific to be back. I mean, to see people, not only people that I hadn't seen for a long time, but actually members of my own team that I'd hired entirely online and hadn't actually met yet in the flesh. That was a remarkable thing.
Absolutely. How interesting. That's Dr. Roger Barker, who's Director of Policy at the Institute of Directors, the IOJ. So another big week sport-wise, of course. It's the Olympic Games. And here to tell me what's been happening is Ben Winstanley, our assistant sports editor. Ben, team gold for team eventing. That show jumping, equestrian, cross-country, first time since 72?
Absolutely, yeah. So first time won it in that event since 1972 in Munich, where Captain Mark Phillips was part of that team. Oliver Townend, Laura Collett and Tom McEwen saw us through to gold today. They were leading after the dressage and the cross-country elements of the on the first 2 days, and it was show jumping today, and they cruised to victory, really.
Really good. Captain Cost actually ages me, Captain Mark Phillips, because I don't think he was quite... Was he married to Princess Anne then, or was he about to get married? Can't remember. So was it a surprise that they... Were they expected to win gold before the Olympics, Ben?
They were one of the favourites, so it certainly wasn't a surprise after the first two rounds, because they've done so much of the groundwork already, but there's always a chance that they can knock the bar off, so there's it was never guaranteed, but a very good morning.
Okay,
in Tokyo.
And have we got any other medal prospects in the next 24 hours, Ben, do you think?
There's two boxers tomorrow. We've got Pat McCormack going tomorrow afternoon, and the following day, Ben Whittaker.
Right.
So we've got an 11 strong boxing team, with five of them have very good medal shouts.
Oh, good.
And a couple of extra quarterfinals to come later in the week. So,
and we're still in the top six in the medals table.
Absolutely.
I really hope we get past Australia.
Yeah, well, one behind Russia now.
What are they doing in there anyway?
Well,
they've been banned from international sport because they call themselves the Russian Olympic Committee. It's a disgrace, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think there are. A lot of people feel the same. A lot of the athletes out there feel the same. We had last week Luke Greenbank, the British swimmer, calling them out after he lost the backstroke final to a Russian. So, it seems like they're Russia in all but name, really.
Well, it's just the Olympics Committee is so useless. And look, finally, Ben, it must talk to you about Harry Kane didn't turn up for training at Tottenham. Does this mean he's off?
Well, it certainly looks that way. Tottenham returned to training today. He was due to be there. He's not shown up. You would imagine that it is an attempt to force through a move to Manchester City, who, as far as we know, haven't actually made a bid for him. He appears to believe that he's got a gentleman's agreement that he'd be able to go this summer.
Right.
And this appears to be his way of trying to force the hand of Chairman Daniel Levy, who has assured the new manager, Nuno, that Kane will not be going.
How interesting, because he's the England captain. It's a funny way to conduct your negotiation. And just finally, if Matt Gatwood was here, of course, I'd be teasing him and tormenting him, because he firmly predicted that we would lose the first Lions match in South Africa, and we won it. And then on Friday, he predicted we would win the second match quite comfortably. And in fact, I think we got stuffed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't really defend his predictions.
I'm not going to ask you to predict what happens in the third one, but they just didn't play very well. They were just overwhelmed.
No, just a bit of a surprise, really, after the first match. On one level, it sets it up very well for the third, and there's been a lot of aggro in the build-up to it, so it should actually be quite a a good match on Saturday.
Very good.
But yeah, maybe Matt can come back and offer a prediction for that.
He says, whenever he predicts, I say, right, I'm going down the bookies to do the opposite. Much as I love him. That's Ben Winstanley, who is, of course, the assistant sports editor here at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. A new book, Painting Britain Blue, Why the Conservatives Keep Winning and How Labour Have Let Them, looks at the history of the UK's two leading political parties in the 20th century, and it asks just that. Why do the Tories keep winning and Labour keep losing? Bearing in mind, it's worth remembering, Labour has not won a general election since 2005. Jamie Parker is a strategy consultant and politics researcher, and he's the author of the book. Jamie, this book should be required reading for Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, and all Labour MPs, because the Tory party, particularly in the since the Second World War, have been dominant.
Absolutely, Andrew, and really that's the intended audience, and that's the audience that needs to read a book like this and really understand some of the lessons that can be learned. And I think one of the problems has been that not enough time has been spent trying to understand not just why Labour have been losing and why Labour have been struggling, but also why have the Conservatives been winning? Why have the Conservatives been winning over those voters? It's not enough to simply say, you know, we've let the voters down and, you know, somehow those voters were forced to vote Conservative. They had no choice. You have to go much further in trying to understand what's been happening in British electoral politics. And part of that, hard as it may be to admit, is there's a real appeal to the Conservative Party in the UK. There's a real appeal to Conservative leaders and Prime Ministers.
So if you had to summarise, bearing in mind, after Tony Blair last won an election in 2005, you then have to go back to Harold Wilson before you find a Labour leader who won a general election. What is it the Tories are saying to voters that's being snapped up that Labour aren't saying?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at that. And I think a lot of it is, one way of answering that question is looking at what did the likes of Harold Wilson and Tony Blair do that other Labour leaders haven't.
Yeah.
And part of that was about positioning themselves as being the future, looking to the future, providing opportunities for aspirational working households. Mm. And in some ways, yes, conceding that their Conservative opponents had done things that were right and appealing. You know, Tony Blair conceded Margaret Thatcher's achievement. He conceded a lot around some of the architecture of the 1980s and the Thatcher reforms, understanding that, you know, for a lot of people, owning their own home, for instance, or, you know, lower taxes or whatever it might have been, you know, more entrepreneurial, enterprising economy, you know, had a lot of appeal. So I think it's partly that. And I think, you know, in terms of the Conservatives, there's certainly certain sort of themes that emerge over the kind of 120-year period that I cover in the book.
On Blair, it's interesting because talk to Labour MPs, talk to Labour Party activists, they despise and revile him, even though he was, by a long chalk, the most successful 20th century leader. He won three unprecedented general elections in a row. And I think Pod potentially might even have won in 2010 when David Cameron limped home in a coalition with the Lib Dems.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the problem as well. And I think, on the one hand, there's this issue with conceding, you know, this idea that if we give ground, if we kind of accept certain things and norms, if we're too responsive to the electorate, then we're not authentic, we're not Labour anymore, you know, and that is a real problem with the way that they look at New Labour and what Tony Blair did to the party. And I think that has overridden the electoral achievements of the New Labour years. It's overridden Tony Blair's appeal and achievements as Labour leader and Prime Minister, and has made it very, very difficult, actually, for anyone to really now make the case for the New Labour project, even if on pure electoral terms it's undeniable what Tony Blair achieved. It was not worth it somehow because of the compromises perhaps that had to be made during that period.
Would you argue also, James, that Britain, or certainly England, is an instinctively small C conservative country, and that the way, particularly the way Jeremy Corbyn took the Labour Party, I would argue almost to the point of Marxism, was never going to wash in England.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very difficult to see how Jeremy Corbyn or a Labour Party under leadership of Jeremy Corbyn could have won a majority, given England is the dominant part of the United Kingdom, you know, in terms of seats, and also in terms of sort of economic heft and political heft. And I think that, you know, there is some truth in that. And I think Wales as well to some extent. I think England and Wales can be grouped, especially sort of provincial England and Wales, and that's sort of putting aside the dynamic in Scotland, which at the moment is obviously incredibly hostile to Labour as well. So, you know, it doesn't paint a very good picture. But yes, I would probably hesitate a bit about inevitability there, and not least because of the sort of contingencies around the 2017 general election, where obviously Corbyn performed much better. But yes, I think overall, definitely, you know, if you look at where Wilson and Blair position the party, especially Blair's efforts to reach voters in Middle England, then yes, you have to, again, it comes back to the thing is you have to concede certain things and accept certain things about the electorate. You have to respond accordingly in terms of the policy package which you offer and the leader that you elect.
And would you argue, what would you say about Sir Keir Starmer's current attempts to, well, I don't know, quite, I mean, my view is I don't know what he's doing with the Labour Party, actually. I have no clue what he stands for. There was that devastating internal report which was leaked to The Observer yesterday by Deborah Mattinson, who is their head of strategy, saying voters simply have no clue what the modern Labour Party stands for or what Sir Keir Starmer stands for. I mean, do you see that they're carrying on making the mistakes they've made before and under Starmer?
I think it's a sort of strategic and tactical problem which the Labour Party has. The tactical problem is how do you respond to quite a singular politician like Boris Johnson, who, like Tony Blair, is able to sort of be very, very manoeuvrable and sort of sprawl over the centre ground, you know, socially a little bit more leaning to the right, but then economically now leading to the left. And I think that is very, very challenging. And it does resemble the sort of challenge the Conservatives had, you know, in the early part of the 21st century when they were facing up against Blair. And then there's the strategic problem which came out of the 2019 election, which is in England and Wales, in provincial England and Wales anyway, the Labour Party has been routed by the Conservative Party. And the Conservative Party annihilated essentially the UKIP, and then the Brexit Party fret and united that sort of coalition of voters. And then in Scotland, of course, Scottish Labour has essentially been in decay since, you know, sort of 2011, really. And so it's a double whammy, really. And actually, either of those alone would be a really massive challenge for any Labour leader. And taken together, you know, they present sort of, it's a sort of decade-long project. You know, we talk about the next election, I think that would be very, very difficult. And then that becomes a problem in itself, doesn't it? Because then if you say the next election is going to be very, very difficult, then Keir Starmer gets labelled as a sort of Neil Kinnock figure, you know, a caretaker figure who is simply managing the party through a very difficult period in order to set it up, you know, for someone else to take over and eventually become Labour Prime Minister.
They will win again, surely. They have to, because that's what we assume. But perhaps we should no longer regard that as inevitable, because of the way the pendulum swings in Britain. Mrs. Thatcher and the Tories were in power for, what, 17, 18 years. Then Blair got in. Labour were in power for, what, 13 years. Tories have been in power for 15, 16, 17 years. You think their time will run out because people will just get fed up with them. But maybe not, looking at, judging by your book.
One of the striking things about the last decade is how the Conservative Party have continued adding votes despite the fact that they've been in power. And that's historically very unusual. You'd usually expect an opposition party to move forward and a governing party to move backwards. Even during the 1980s, you know, Labour was still moving forward in terms of seats. It was very slow, but they were going in the right direction. Whereas in the last 10 years, Labour have been going backwards in opposition and the Conservative Party have been adding votes despite the fact that they've been in government for so long. And one of the sort of successes in some ways, one of the abilities that Boris Johnson kind of demonstrated in the 2019 election was to sort of present himself as something new. And so therefore was able to sort of shed the 9 years that had gone before and sort of reframe the party under his leadership, a new leadership, and present itself as a new government, and therefore appeal to those voters and increase the vote share, even though, as I say, over a long, long period of Conservative government or any government, you wouldn't generally expect the governing party to increase votes in the way that they have.
Interesting. And I wonder if, Jeremy, if Keir Starmer is still in some way tarnished by being a key part of Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet.
Yeah, and I think that makes it very difficult to sort of stand aside, you know, morally from some of the things that happened during the Corbyn years, you know, and take sort of a principled position on that and distance yourself from it, given that, you know, he had every opportunity when he was Shadow Brexit Secretary to resign over the problems in the Labour Party during that period around, you know, anti-Semitism or the fact that, you know, some Labour MPs felt they had to leave the party because it had become such a hostile environment. And he didn't do that. So I think, yeah, there's certain things you can do. He's removed the whip from Jeremy Corbyn, and he's, you know, emphasised in that annoying catchphrase that the party's under new management. Mm. But yes, as you say, it's always going to be a challenge given he'd served under his leadership loyally, really, for all that time.
All right, that's Jamie Parker, who's the author of Painting Britain Blue, Why the Conservatives Keep Winning and How Labour Have Let Them. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.